Many chefs these days are true celebrities with the chance to promote not just their food, but also causes. And chefs gathered in the Brazilian city of São Paulo were talking about biodiversity. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro was there.
If you love food, you've certainly heard their names before. Juan Roca, Ferran Adrià, Alex Atala, Michel Bras, Enrique Olvera. They are so-called super chefs with big names and the Michelin stars that go with them. But here are some unfamiliar names for you to consider. Spread out on a table in front of me are a wealth of unusual fruits and other delicacies from the Amazon region of Brazil. They look as exotic as they sound, with bright colors and unusual textures. The chefs here are meeting to discuss food biodiversity, hence the display. It's no coincidence the meeting is happening in Brazil. Latin America is one of the most biodiverse places on Earth. There are also strong culinary traditions here with deep roots. But studies also show that in countries like Brazil, diverse traditional foods are being replaced with industrialized convenience foods. Alex Atala's Dom restaurant in Sao Paulo has been rated one of the best in the world. The event today is partially sponsored by his Ata Institute, which focuses on sustainability in the Amazon. And I ask him, what impact can the rarefied world of high cuisine have on what's available to people at their local supermarket?
The real cuisine, it is not something that a chef on, people on. This is very important. Chef is just a way to spread the idea or the new flavor or the new concept, the new ingredient. About 20 years ago, chefs didn't have this voice that we have nowadays. So personally, I believe that the cross line between nature and culture is food.
That intersection, that cultural space which food and chefs now occupy, has never been more powerful, says Enrique Olvera of Mexico City's Pujol and New York City's Cosme.
The fact that we're doing this might inspire the restaurant next door, and they'll embrace some of these ideas, and then they'll do it themselves. The most beautiful example is Alice Waters and Chef Panisse. She started a movement that now it's in stadiums, in airports. You see now her influence about organic, about local, about simple, about honest. At some point, this will become mainstream as well.
When you lose products, you are losing flavors and traditions, he says.
Today, I learned about a purveyor of honey in Mexico that I didn't know about. And when I go back to my country, I'll make sure I know them. So I think it's about sharing.
The most famous chef of them all is Ferran Adrià, formerly of El Bulli in Spain. He says connecting restaurants and producers is what events like this are all about.
If I have the best honey in the world next to me, I'll use it. Maybe it's not the best, but a local producer is making it, so I decide I'll help these people who are producing the honey. Imagine this multiplied for millions of restaurants in the world.
It's a grand vision, but he says it just makes sense.
I think there's a lot more consciousness about these things than 30 years ago. But the role of this isn't to save the world. It's to make sure the next generation who are studying gastronomy can have the information and they can make decisions.
Needless to say, the event, of course, was punctuated by a meal, beans and rice with roast pig. For dessert, rare, locally sourced fruit. Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR News, Sao Paulo.
I have a feeling someone is going to eat well during this next story. It takes us to Mexico City, where Chef Margarita Carrillo Arante wants to inspire you with Mexican recipes. Forget the nachos and refried beans and burritos. Carrillo has more, she says. She spent years gathering hundreds of simple recipes from every region of the country for her cookbook, which is now being described as the Bible of Mexican cuisine. NPR's Carrie Kahn visited Carrillo in her kitchen.
On a chilly morning, Margarita Carrillo warmly greets me at her home high in the hills above the capital. I brought a pot of Mexican hot chocolate and some sweet bread to share. Sitting at her kitchen table, we quickly dive into the treats and her thoughts on cooking.
It's delicious. It's very, very good. I have a slice of maca bread.
Carrillo says at its core, Mexican cooking is simple and easy. She says her book reflects that philosophy.
And I tried to give simple instructions. I wanted to just, when they read it, it's, oh, I'll just do it like that with no stress, no worry.
With over 700 pages and 600 recipes, the book at first glance can be daunting, but most of the recipes are really just a paragraph long with prep and cook times under 20 minutes. There are 40 different salsas, 15 egg dishes, and lots of street food favorites. We decide to make a baked fish dish with a spicy, nutty marinade paste on top.
Okay, chintextle.
Chintextle.
Yes, it's one of these pastes, energetic pastes.
It's made with smoked chilies, shrimp, garlic, pumpkin seeds, and dried avocado leaves. All the ingredients are dry roasted in a frying pan or a flat cast iron disc known as a comal.
Okay. Now the seeds. We'll dry roast the seeds.
So you just have a frying pan?
Yeah, just
nothing on
nothing.
It.
Nothing.
One of the misconceptions Carrillo battles about Mexican food is that it's greasy and oily.
In all of Mexico, there's the traditional cooking techniques. It's comal, steaming, boiling, hot stones, and the pit.
Oil and deep frying, she says, is a modern import.
This technique wasn't ours. It was brought to us by the Spaniards.
Carrillo is the real deal. In a growing field of Mexican celebrity chefs, she insists on keeping it simple. There's no Asian or Mediterranean fusion in her cooking, no foam or fancy layers either. When New York-based publisher Fiden came looking for someone to add to their line of authentic, country-specific cookbooks, they went straight to Carrillo. Gloria Lopez Morales, president of Mexico's Gastronomic Conservatory, says Fiden had many great Mexican cooks to choose from. But she says Margarito is the most authoritative to write such a book. Until recently, Carrillo owned restaurants in San Jose de los Cabos and Mexico City. She has a popular cooking show on the Latin American Gourmet cable channel. And Carrillo was part of a decade-long campaign to get Mexican cuisine listed on the UNESCO Cultural Heritage List. Carrillo says she wants everyone, Mexicans included, to appreciate the cuisine and its techniques.
You know that is really, really outstanding, the way this cuisine has survived through the centuries. Of course, it evolves, but you can eat the same tortilla that Moctezuma had 500 years ago.
After dry roasting the chilies, garlic, dried shrimps, and pumpkin seeds, Carrillo mixes everything in a food processor and adds some apple cider vinegar to smooth it all out. In a clay baking dish, she lines the bottom with a splash of olive oil, some sliced onions, then places a fresh chunk of local robalo fish. The whole thing is topped with herbs, covered with aluminum foil, and slid into the oven. After a few minutes, we get to sample.
Mmm, it's delicious. Congratulations.
I didn't make it, you did. I just watched.
It's very good. Very good. And so easy and so healthy. So be adventurous.
Carrillo says you will be surprised at how easy authentic Mexican cooking can be. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Mexico City.
Let's hear about a rise in prices that, while tough on consumers, is a lifeline for cattle ranchers recovering from a long drought. The price of beef is up 20% over last year, hitting record levels for some cuts of meat. And on Texas ranches, that's good news. Andrew Schneider of Houston Public Media paid a visit to one of them.
A sprawling ranch known as 44 Farms covers thousands of acres in Cameron, Texas, about 2 hours' drive northwest of Houston. On this flat expanse of open land, cattlemen raise Black Angus, the most common breed of beef cattle in the United States. On a recent warm Saturday, the ranch held its fall auction. Owner Bob McLaren says his family has been raising cattle here for more than a century, breeding top-of-the-line bulls and females.
These have been through many stages of culling, making sure that we have the best genetics offering today.
Genetics in this case covers everything from the quality of the meat to ease of delivery for calves. None of the animals at this sale are headed for the dinner table anytime soon. They will be giving birth to a new generation of cattle. Until recently, most Texas ranchers were reducing the size of their herds as they struggled with years of drought. A relentless sun withered the grasses and grains that cattle eat. During the worst of it, feed costs soared for ranchers.
You know, our grasses were dying just from the lack of moisture. And we're feeding just corn stalks and anything else we could find to maintain the cattle through that tough time.
Finally, ranchers had to respond by reducing herds to cut costs.
The drought was so severe for so long, and the feed prices were so high that you just couldn't do that forever.
David Anderson is a livestock economist with the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service.
We do have producers who were forced to sell off all their herds. A lot of those beef cows did go to slaughter.
Such moves pushed the U.S. cattle inventory to its lowest level since 1951. Meanwhile, the U.S. economy has been improving, so more Americans want to grill beef again. Now the demand for beef is rising, just as packing plants are running out of excess supplies. The result is predictable. Beef and cattle prices are going through the roof. Consumers may hate it, but those higher prices are making it possible for ranchers to purchase expensive feed in those areas like the Panhandle and North Central Plains, where land remains badly parched. In other parts of Texas, the drought has eased, allowing ranchers to start rebuilding herds. That means Bob McLaren is seeing strong demand for his cattle. Again, Texas A&M economist David Anderson.
We have had calf prices at auction pushing $3 a pound. That is twice as much as what we would have thought in the past being tremendously high prices.
The fall auction at 44 farms drew hundreds of bidders. The ranch made roughly $3 million in just a few hours, more than double the take from last year's fall sale. McLaren is already gearing up for his next auction in February. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
We are really spreading the news around this morning. This next report is about mayonnaise and a basic question. What is it? The answer may determine the outcome of a lawsuit that feels like a struggle between David and Goliath. The nation's leading brand, Hellmann's, is suing an upstart known as Just Mayo. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Several years back, a young entrepreneur named Josh Tetrick, who had more charisma than cash, decided to take on the mayo industry. His strategy? Get rid of the eggs and reinvent the spread using ground-up peas.
Just Mayo is a mayo product that uses plants instead of chicken eggs, and that's a part of the broader philosophy of the company to do food a little bit differently in a way that's hopefully significantly more sustainable, less water, less emission.
And maybe better for you. At least that's part of his pitch. Meanwhile, Unilever, the global food giant that owns Hellmann's, was sitting pretty. They were doing well the way they'd always done well.
The family gathers, new babies here.
In this old TV ad, a jar of Hellmann's mayonnaise sits front and center on a fancy holiday table.
Everything was great, Grandma.
And it wouldn't be home without Hellmann's.
This is the way mayonnaise was marketed in the past, but Tetrick says his product, Just Mayo, is about the future. And now he's doing pretty well. Just Mayo is on the shelves of some major supermarket chains, from Walmart to Whole Foods. But Unilever says there's a problem here. 2 weeks ago, they filed a lawsuit, pointing out that the Food and Drug Administration's legal definition of mayonnaise is a spread that contains eggs. Just Mayo has no eggs. In a statement sent to us by Unilever, the company says, quote, "We simply wish to protect both consumers from being misled and also our brand."
Sometimes it seems almost silly, but companies protect their brand at all costs.
That's John Stanton, a professor of food marketing at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. He says if Unilever's lawyers can use decades-old regulations defining what constitutes mayonnaise in order to protect their brand's market share, they'll do it.
There's no question that Hellmann's is swinging a sledgehammer to kill an ant. And if I was the Just Mayo, I'd be sitting back saying, you know, I'm getting more attention than I could have ever paid for.
The media has dubbed this the mayonnaise war. There have been headlines such as Hold the Mayo, and brand consultant Eloy Trevino of the Profit Group in Chicago says this public fight might just leave Hellmann's with egg on its face.
When you look at the way the story is unfolded, it just looks like sour grapes by a big company against a brand that has a great purpose and a great product.
He says if he were advising Unilever, he'd tell them to think more about their purpose.
Today, consumers are gravitating toward and becoming advocates for brand with a strong brand purpose.
And Trevino says with Hellmann's, Unilever does have a really strong brand.
Anytime you have a brand dating back 100 years, there's a ton of trust, there's a ton of equity.
And he says that's worth a lot. Now, the mayonnaise war may not be ending anytime soon. The company behind Just Mayo is fighting back and plans to file a countersuit in the coming weeks. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.